Hello, friends. Welcome to episode two of the David O. Stewart Show. Season one is The Democracy We Must Keep, which is his newest book. This month, we have the privilege of interviewing Stephen Wilson, the executive director of the St. John's Church Foundation in Richmond, Virginia. So, this is a really important conversation because we're going to talk about Patrick Henry. So, I'm going to throw it over to David and welcome Stephen. I'm Hope Katz-Gibbs, proud producer of the show on Incandescent Radio and Incandescent TV. I can't wait to hear this conversation.
Thank you, Hope. Stephen, it's wonderful to have you here. I appreciate your coming. And the focus in my book on Patrick Henry is on his famous speech, Where You Are, where he said the ineffable pledge, give me liberty or give me death. And that helped ignite the flames of the American Revolutionary War. But first, let's get a little background about, first of all, the church. It is an active church, right?
It is. So this is the oldest church in the city of Richmond. The front door, you can't see it, but I'm just going to point that way. Opened in 1741. People have been worshiping here since 1741, although, in those times, this was not called St. John's Church. This was part of the Church of England. It was the Henrico Parish Church. And the Henrico Parish actually has its origins going all the way back to 1611 at the city of Henricus. So it's an old place. People have been worshiping here a long time. I'm not with the church, so we're not involved with religious
Right.
activities. The foundation's involved with preservation of the property, as well as our educational mission.
And you're also open during the week for history lovers.
We are. Thank you for coming last year. It was good to meet you. And you
Yes.
humored me because I was feeling particularly theatrical that day, and you and your wife allowed me to deliver the speech. So thank you for that.
It was a great treat. Now we're going to be in 1775, and who was Patrick Henry in 1775?
Yeah, so Patrick Henry, he's born in 1736 in Hanover County, about a 20-minute drive north of here at a place called Studley. Very humble beginnings. Unlike many of the founding fathers, Patrick Henry did not have an elite education. In fact, he did not even attend college. He learned from his father at home. He, at a very young age, tried his hand running his father's store. When I say young, I mean teenager age. He was not particularly successful at that. The store closed within a year. He tried his hand at farming, and he was not particularly successful at that either. But where he found his calling was when he decided to read for the law. He was quite an attorney. He passes the bar and becomes an attorney in 1760.
Well, but wait, he didn't read much for the law, though.
Didn't read much for the law. Yeah, thank you for that clarification. But he becomes an attorney at a young age, 1760, and he has a sharp wit, an outstanding memory. But more than anything else, Patrick Henry has an ability, unlike almost anyone else, to persuade through public speech. So he is an outstanding attorney who rises to fame in 1763 in the Parson's Cause trial up in Hanover. So he becomes a well-known person throughout Virginia. But then at 1765, he's elected to the Virginia House of Burgesses. And he's going to introduce legislation called the Virginia Resolves into the House of Burgesses to oppose the Stamp Act. And the Virginia Resolves will get published in newspapers throughout the colonies. And by the age of 28 years old, Patrick Henry in 1765 is going to be a household name throughout the colonies. So if we fast forward another 10 years, we get to 1775 in St. John's Church, the Second Virginia Convention. Patrick Henry is a member of the House of Burgesses, although they had been dissolved the year prior. Very accomplished attorney. Known, widely regarded as the number one orator in Virginia through impassioned speeches. Henry has a tendency, I got some spectacles just out of reach, but Henry would wear his spectacles and he would rip them off mid-speech. And that was a good indicator that this was going to be a particularly impassioned speech. That's who was here in 1775.
So, give us a quick run-up to the session we're talking about, which was in the summer of 1775. What's going on between America and Britain that brings this about?
Yeah, I'll take your listeners back to the fourth grade. So we all know about the Boston Tea Party. That was in December of 1773. You've got 342 chests of tea dumped into the harbor. And it's going to take a little bit of time for England to find out about the events of the Boston Tea Party. But in March of 1774, about a year to the day before we get here, Parliament is going to pass the first of what are called the Coercive Acts. And the colonies, they're going to call these the Intolerable Acts. And the Intolerable Acts are going to meant to punish Massachusetts for their involvement in the Boston Tea Party. I'm not going to list them all, but you know, these are going to include the Quartering Act. You're going to have British soldiers sent over from England to Boston. They're going to be housed in private citizens' homes at the expense of the homeowner. So the homeowner is going to have to feed the British soldier. And you can imagine that tensions will rise because of this. You've got the Boston Port Act, where Boston Harbor is going to be closed until the debt from the dumped tea is repaid. I mention all of this because here in Virginia, your members of the House of Burgesses, men like Washington and Jefferson and Henry, are monitoring the situation up in Massachusetts, and they're concerned. They're concerned that what's happening up in Massachusetts could happen here in Virginia. And they decide in the summer of, in May of 1774, they decide that they're going to show their support for Massachusetts as a group, as a legislative body, by fasting and praying. And then the royal governor of Virginia, he's the last royal governor, his name is John Murray. We know him in history as Lord Dunmore. He'll be one of our bad guys in the story. Lord Dunmore will retaliate against the members of the House of Burgesses by dissolving that group. And so they have, as of the summer of 1774, they have no legal authority. And so members of the House of Burgesses go down to Williamsburg, to the Raleigh Tavern, and they come up with a plan. And what they decide is that they're going to, even though they don't have legal authority, they're going to meet in a series of meetings without the governor's participation that are called the Virginia Conventions. There are going to be five Virginia Conventions. The first one's in Williamsburg. The second one will be here. Now, what happens at the first Virginia Convention is delegates are elected from Virginia to the First Continental Congress up in Philadelphia. Henry is one of those delegates elected. It's one of the few times that he left Virginia in his entire life. At the second Virginia Convention, March of 1775, the primary order of business will be to elect delegates to the second Continental Congress. But Patrick Henry's got some other ideas.
Well, why are they in Richmond? Williamsburg was always the capital of Virginia.
Good question. So Richmond's not going to be the capital for another few years, 1780. I would attribute three reasons why they met here. The number one reason, I'm going to have to go to my PowerPoint presentation now, but this is why. You didn't know I was going to do this. This is what the church would have looked like in 1741. It's a very, let me go a little higher. Can you see it?
Perfect.
Okay. So that's what the church would have looked like. Rectangular structure, modest, but the population of Richmond's only 200 people at the time. In 1772, Richmond's population is tripled, and it is decided that an addition be put onto this building. I'm actually standing in the addition right now. I'm standing in this structure here.
Got it.
And so it's shaped like a T. This building in 1772 becomes the largest building in Virginia outside of Williamsburg. It is an ideal meeting location because it's big enough to hold the 120 delegates who attended the Second Virginia Convention. Reason number one. Reason number two is that the rector of this church, and again, this is part of the Church of England. His name in history, Reverend Miles Selden, is known as the Patriot Parson. And Reverend Miles Selden is sympathetic towards the delegates' cause, and he allows them to come to this church to talk about revolution. Reason number three, you said, how come not Williamsburg? Distance.
Yeah.
We are right now on the eve of war. March 23rd, 1775 is 27 days before those shots are fired up in Massachusetts. They didn't want to meet in Williamsburg because there was concern that the Redcoats would get sent. And this ultimately doesn't happen. But the 50 miles of distance between where I'm standing and Williamsburg would offer a level of protection for the delegates to slip out in case the Redcoats are sent in.
So that's great for setting the scene. Just give us who was there in the I guess it was called the convention at the time.
Yeah, the second Virginia Convention.
Give us the all-stars who were in the audience.
So all your founding fathers, you had seven signers of the Declaration of Independence from Virginia. Six of them were here. The seventh one, George Wythe, is actually buried right outside. But you had George Washington was here, and he was for Patrick Henry's resolution. That the big thing that happens at this convention, besides give me liberty or give me death, is that Patrick Henry is going to propose on the morning of March 23rd a resolution for Virginia to establish a well-regulated militia, to position the colony into a state of defense in readiness for war against the mother country. So Henry is saying, you know, we're not just electing delegates to the Second Continental Congress. We need to decide if we're going to go to war or not. So some of those who were in favor of the resolution would have included George Washington, who was representing Fairfax County up in Northern Virginia. Thomas Jefferson, we all know him, will be representing Albemarle County. He will be also in favor of Patrick Henry's resolution. Richard Henry Lee, who lives down in Westmoreland County, is known as the second greatest orator in Virginia after Patrick Henry. I think that's widely accepted. He will second the resolution, and another person who is in favor of the resolution will be Thomas Nelson, who sits almost directly behind me. I think he's 32 years old. He'll represent the county of York. So we have several future signers of the Declaration of Independence in favor of the resolution. Now, some of those who were against it, and it was almost half in the room who were against, Robert Carter Nicholas, the treasurer of the colony, Benjamin Harrison V from Charles City County, not the president, he will be against, and Edmund Pendleton from Caroline County. These are just a few of the names who were against. It's almost an even split for and against.
But that Harrison was an ancestor of the man who became president.
Yes.
And also William Henry Harrison.
That's correct, yes.
Harrison's stuck around a long time.
Yeah. Yeah, they so they lived, for your listeners, they lived down at Berkeley Plantation. It's about maybe a 20-minute drive from Richmond.
So what's the moment when Henry rises? Is he presenting his resolution?
Yes, yeah, so Patrick Henry will present a resolution, resolve, therefore, that this colony be immediately put into a posture of defense. And then, you know, after he proposes the resolution, Richard Henry Lee, who's seated on the other side of the church, will second the resolution. So he'll, you know, he'll call to the president of the convention, who is Peyton Randolph. He'll second it. And then you've got arguments and debates both for the resolution and against the merits of the resolution. So there'll be a lot of arguing and debating going on. And this is what, for visitors who come here and check out our reenactment, that's what they'll see. They'll see nine actors around this church, you know, arguing the merits of the resolution. And after all of this argument, after all the arguing happens, Henry will rise. He will call to the president of the convention. Henry gets the floor. He delivers the speech.
And he's got a sense of timing, huh?
Good sense of timing.
So was the mood acrimonious, or were they still trying to talk and listen to each other?
So you know, you had people on very different sides. You know, in our reenactment, I'll use Thomas Nelson as an example. You know, Thomas Nelson will say, you know, I'm a merchant from Yorktown. I derive much profit from my trade with England. You know, but why should we raise up our fortunes when they may be taken from us at the leisure of others? Tyranny and naked aggression must be met with preparation and fortitude. Let me say this, and I call upon God to witness. If any British troops arrive in the county of York, where I am lieutenant, I will await no orders. I will summon the militia and drive the invaders to the water's edge, to arms. That doesn't sound too acrimonious to me.
Well, that's pretty feisty.
Pretty feisty.
Now, I can attest from that day last year that you are a powerful interpreter of Patrick Henry's speech, and you know it very well.
Thank you.
As well as Mr. Nelson. Can you give us a feel for it?
All right. Well, I've done my costume change. I've got my 1700s jacket on. I've got my spectacles on, and I got my wig on. Before I start, though, I just want to mention that, you know, and I'm not trying to do this to deflate, but we don't know exactly what Patrick Henry said. And I say that because his speeches were never written down, which kind of begs the question, well, you know, how do you know what he said? Patrick Henry's initial biographer, a man by the name of William Wirt, cobbled together the speech some 30 plus years after it was first delivered by interviewing people who were still living that gave firsthand accounts of what Patrick Henry said. And so it was William Wirt in the early 1800s that actually wrote the speech. So, you know, what I like to tell people is that what you are about to hear would be the gist. It will not be word for word what Patrick Henry actually said because he didn't write his speeches down.
You are explaining the reason why I almost omitted it from my book, because is it actually a document? We all know that people's memory after 30 years, rarely improves. So it's hard to know, but if work did his work well, and talked to a number of people who did, consistent views.
Yeah, and no, that's absolutely correct. I like to always add that William Wirt is generally regarded as a big fan of Patrick Henry. And so did he embellish because he was a big fan? There's no way of knowing that. But I do like to say it's the gist. So,
well, and Wirt was no slouch, wasn't he, Attorney General?
That's correct. Yeah, Wirt was. Yeah, he was a very prominent Virginian.
Yeah.
All right. So I'm going to call to the president of the convention, Peyton Randolph, and he's going to give me the floor. And I'll start by saying, no man thinks more highly than I do of the patriotism as well as the abilities of the very worthy gentlemen who have just addressed this House. But different men oftentimes see the same subject in different lights. So I shall hope that it not be thought of as disrespectful to those gentlemen if, entertaining as I do, opinions of a character very opposite to theirs, I shall set forth my sentiments freely and without reserve. This is no time for ceremony. The question before this House is one of awful moment to our country. For my part, I shall consider it as nothing less than a question of freedom or slavery. And in proportion to the magnitude of the subject ought to be the freedom of the debate. And so that's a little flavor for the beginning of the speech. And I always like to include the beginning because Henry, you know, he's 38 years old. He is not the most senior person. He's not the youngest guy in the room, but he's not the most senior person either. And so he is, I believe, showing, you know, respect and deference to those older members in the convention, men like Peyton Randolph and Richard Bland and others. And he's kind of just starting to get fired up. We haven't taken the glasses off yet, but if we move forward through this 8-minute speech and we get to its dramatic conclusion, there'll be a very different tone. It is in vain to extenuate the matter. Gentlemen may cry, peace, peace, but there is no peace. The war has actually begun. The next gale that sweeps from the north shall bring to our ears the clash of resounding arms. Our brethren already in the field. Why stand we here idle? What is it that the gentlemen wish? What would they have? Is life so dear or peace so sweet as to be purchased at the price of chains and slavery? Forbid it, Almighty God. I know not what course others may take, but as for me, give me liberty or give me death. So very, very dramatic. Now, I tend to portray it a little bit more fiery than some of our actors here, but you get the idea that, you know, he is wound up and he's trying to convince these delegates that they need to vote for the resolution, not against.
Well, I'll just fill in. You did skip over a passage I love, which is the chains are already clanking on the plains of Boston.
Our chains are forged. Their clanking can be heard upon the plains of Boston. The war is inevitable. And let it come. I repeat it, let it come.
Yeah, that feels to me very much like just a powerful statement of, I am ready. We all should be ready. It's time.
Yeah.
Now, can you, what do we know about the impact of the speech in the room? Did his resolution carry?
So, no, great question. So when we perform reenactments, you know, typically Henry finishes his speech and there's a lot of applause and people are really excited. Yeah. He did. What a great speech. But that's not historically accurate. We know that on March 23rd, 1775, that there was this hushed silence that came over the room. Delegates had heard the speech. They know that there's going to be a vote in just a matter of moments. So they are processing what Henry said, and they're contemplating, you know, what they're about to do next. So it's not the reaction that you might think. There's actually this silence, and then there's going to be a vote. And you asked if the resolution passes. It does, but it passes very narrowly. We know that, and it's a voice vote. We know that it passes by only 4 or 5 votes. And we actually don't know how every single delegate voted. We know how most of them voted, but there are certain ones where, because it is a voice vote, there's no written account. We don't know how every single delegate who was in attendance voted.
Well, I have heard actors say that sometimes the most admiring response to a performance is when the audience is just struck dumb.
Yeah.
And they're silent and they're just processing it. It was so remarkable. Their emotions have been stirred so much. And it's hard not to imagine that there was a lot of that in the response to Henry's speech.
Yeah. And, you know, so the resolution is going to pass. And, you know, I would just remind your listeners that Virginia is the largest colony in area. You know, it's the largest colony in population and in wealth. It's a big deal to have Virginia on the side of revolution. And like I said, those shots were fired, you know, not less than with 27 days later up in Massachusetts. Virginia will send troops up to Massachusetts in July. So it's a big deal. This is the American Revolution, not the Massachusetts Revolution.
So is there a distribution of the gist of his speech around the colonies? Do other newspapers, you know, newspapers tended to steal stories from each other in that era because there was no formal news aggregation service?
I would, and this is speculation on my part, I would tend to doubt that there was a written account of the entire speech. I don't know that for sure, but I would tend to doubt that. But what we do know is that liberty or death became a rallying cry in the colonies. I actually saw, somebody sent me a photo last night of a purple heart that dated to the 1780s that said liberty or death on it. And so liberty or death becomes this very famous saying, you know, even back in the 1700s.
Isn't there a flag with liberty or death on it?
Or death or liberty, yes.
Yeah. So now, what, in your judgment, made the speech so powerful? Was it the words, the delivery, or is it impossible to sort of look at them separately?
Yeah, so in my opinion, I think it's probably both. You know, Henry had an ability to have dramatic pauses. He would inflect. He would be angry. He would be impassioned. He would have gestures and pointing and ripping off the glasses and, you know, all of these theatrics that worked. And so I would argue that while there were many delegates here at the convention that were not going to have their mind changed, there were enough that were on the fence that Henry was able to convince. So I think part of it was probably delivery, and the other part of it being the words that, you know, that he said. I think it was Jefferson who said that Henry spoke as Homer wrote. And so I think the words were certainly important, but the delivery also is very important.
Yeah. Now, he continued in public service for most of the rest of his life. Can you give us a quick overview of what he went on to do?
Yeah, he's, you know, he becomes the first governor of an armed and independent Virginia. Back then, you know, you had 1-year terms, and Henry is going to end up serving 5 terms. They weren't all consecutive. He serves 3 in the 1770s, and then in the 1780s, he's going to serve another 2. But he's a very prominent Virginia, especially as governor, but he doesn't go on to hold national office. He only leaves Virginia just a couple of times in his entire life, which is why he's extremely well known in Virginia. But sometimes in other parts of the country, people don't know him because he didn't go on to become president or hold national office. He dies in 1799.
Okay. Can you sort of describe his relationship with George Washington, which was, of course, a central issue in the new nation?
Yeah. Well, so Henry, you know, one of his concerns as the nation was founded was that that America could kind of become like another England, meaning the government have too much power. And so we're kind of fast forwarding a little bit, but Henry was not a fan of the Constitution. He was instrumental in having the Bill of Rights added in. But back in 1775, you know, Henry and Washington are on the same page. I mean, Washington is for Henry's resolution. Of course, you know, Washington goes on to become, you know, the leader of the troops in the Continental Army. I don't know if that directly answers your question.
Yeah, but they ultimately, I mean, they did have a dust up over the Constitution, and Henry is impassioned about it in the ratification convention, but they end up reconciling.
Yeah, unlike Mr. Jefferson, they had their dust up too.
Yeah, Washington didn't pick fights, but if he was presented with a fight, he didn't give up his opinions at all.
Yeah, always. And we don't know for sure if Washington spoke during the convention here. In our reenactment, he does. We take some things he had said in letters, and he does have a speaking role. And in the reenactment, he'll say, you know, the sword of our defense is forged upon the anvil of necessity. I urge that these resolutions be adopted. But we're not sure that he actually spoke. What we do know is that he supported the resolution.
Yeah, he was reluctant to speak in public. His voice was not very good.
Right.
He was always afraid that he would be flat-footed. Right. You can never make a mistake if you don't try. So, you know, Stephen, this has been fabulous. Thank you so much for giving us this great information and also for helping us feel the moment. It's been a treat. Thank you.
Well, thank you. And, you know, we celebrated the 250th anniversary of Patrick Henry's speech last year. So we were a little on the on the front end of all these 250 celebrations. I will add that Ken Burns, the PBS filmmaker, was here. He was actually seated about 4 feet from where I'm standing right now. He was our keynote speaker. And he said that and this is a plug, an infomercial for our reenactment, but he said that our reenactment was one of the best historical performances that he's ever seen. So I would just say to your listeners, if you ever have a chance to come to St. John's and see the reenactment, it is a heck of a performance.
I bet it is.
It absolutely is. I've had the privilege of being there, Stephen, and it's such an amazing church. The cemetery outside has some really famous people, and what you do is just really important, bringing history alive.
Yeah,
so thank you, Stephen Wilson, Executive Director of St. John's Church Foundation, and of course, our host, David O. Stewart, author of many, many books about the Founding Fathers and his most recent, The Democracy We Must Keep. I'm Hope Katz-Gibbs, proud producer of the show on Incandescent Radio and Incandescent TV. This is episode 2 of many to come, where we talk about the power and importance of the founders and democracy. We will see you again soon. Thank you all so much for listening.